Hi, my name is Londe Yusuf.
And my name is Reggie Williams.
And we're the co-founders of Black Film Space. Black Film Space is a grassroots organization dedicated to enhancing the skill sets of Black filmmakers and building a community of creatives. We host events such as screenwriting workshops, panels, mixers, and other events that are designed to support Black content creators.
In the next episode of the Black Film Space podcast, we interview Denise Woods, a dialect coach. Denise has worked with Mahershala Ali in Green Book and True Detective, Cynthia Erivo in Harriet, and Will Smith in Ali. We talk with Denise about the process of perfecting a dialect, collaborating with directors, and working with actors to build a character's voice, and much more. And now, on to our interview. All right, Denise, thank you so much for joining us on the Black Film Space podcast. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. Thank you for taking time out of your day to speak with us.
My pleasure.
We are really excited to speak with you as you are a professional dialect coach. Mm-hmm. And hopefully by the end of this, we can get some tips on our own podcast. That'd be amazing.
Sounds great.
But as a dialect coach, can you explain exactly what your role is in telling the story and what you do on set or before set?
Well, actually, it does start before we get to set. And I liken it to what the set designer or costume designer or sound designer, all of those elements, the visual elements of a film and the sound elements of a film, how the character's sound is equally as important as those other elements. So essentially, how the character sounds is just as important as how the character looks. And so what I do is I go in with the actor and we sort of curate a particular sound that they feel the character would have based on several things, based on where they're from, based on their educational level, based on their parents, their community. Lots of wonderful external influences go into crafting the way a person sounds. Age, for instance, culture, background, race. All of those wonderful nuances go into, if it's a period piece, really the dialect really does evolve as periods evolve, as cultures evolve. I'm pretty much a historian. I take a historical approach to this because the way people sound, say, before the automobile or before the advent of the railroad, because people didn't have a way of getting around, going from one neighborhood to another. And so they were very insular and stayed in their communities, and pretty much everybody sounded the same. And once people started traveling outside of their communities and started being affected and influenced by other communities, and even educationally, you know, started getting out of their communities to travel to university and colleges all around the country, dialects change. And so the influence in a historical context is really what really tickles my fancy. I mean, all the other things are great to talk about the cultural specificity, but the cultural racial specificity in the context of history, what was going on during this period, and we really sort of dissect why people sound the way they do. And like I said, it's a myriad of reasons, but it becomes very, very complex and very interesting when you really delve into it in a historical context.
Yeah, I always wondered how historians and how you know how people sounded maybe like 200 years ago, where I'm pretty sure there wasn't technology that could record voices. So how do you determine how the accuracy of that?
What a great question, because that's what I love doing. let's take African American, Southern Texas, say. African Americans in Texas, and I'm doing a piece set in the 1960s. And I'm looking, actually, let's go back, set in the early 1900s. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you, I started the dialect work on The Harder They Fall, the new Idris Elba movie that's mm-hmm. being shot now in New Mexico. I didn't join the movie once COVID, once they started up in post-COVID, because I just didn't want to take the risk of, you know, being on set at this juncture. So I, but I started the film, I prepped everybody, we were there, we shut down 4 days, you know, before we flew home, 4 days before we were scheduled to shoot the film. So we were right there, ready to go. These people in this film, it's set in 1890. And so clearly some of them, African-Americans, it's set in New Mexico. It's a Western kind of vibe. So people are coming, people are nomadic. Black folks are coming from all over. Some are coming from the South, escaping slavery, escaping the Reconstruction period, because if it's the 1890s, it's actually post-Reconstruction, and it's just before the lynching period. And these folks were moving west. They were moving north to Chicago, but these groups were moving west. And clearly, to your point, how do you search for how these people would sound? Because we're talking pre-recording. Recordings started happening around the turn of the century, Edison, but that was in New Jersey, and they were white folks. And so a Black person in the South didn't have access to recording devices. So, you know, the most we would see is a photograph, a grainy photograph of that period of someone, but clearly no recordings. And so these people, as I said, are coming from the South. Some of them are coming from the North to forge westward for new opportunities. Where do you go? I go to older people for whom they were raised by their grandparents. Sometimes I go to slave narratives that are currently in the Library of Congress and listen to those. You know, I was the dialect coach on Harriet, and those kinds of narratives and the specificity of where she was in Maryland, that was easier to do because I had all of those, that wonderful anthology of these sounds and these people, albeit they were old, but it was still like a blueprint. This 1890 was not easy. There were no blueprints. And so therefore the actor's imagination has to come into play. And the resources that I then go to are, even though these are not old people, I go to older generations because the older generations will remember what their grandparents sounded like. And their grandparents and great grandparents are the people that we're talking about. And so those older generation, the great grandparents of you, your great grandparents, my grandparents, would be the good sample of what those people would sound like, because they are closer historically, chronologically, and culturally mm-hmm. to those people. So that's where we start. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. Got you.
Mm-hmm. It's fun.
No, it sounds like a ton of fun. It sounds like there's an integration of like being a historian and of dialect culture.
You know, I feel like an anthropologist.
Yeah.
You know, I think the reason why, if you look at my background and my biography, people often wonder, you know, do you only do Black films? Do you only do Black people? Aren't you a dialect coach? I say, I do everything. I really do. It's like a musician who can play all genres of music, but they prefer jazz because they just feel it. And that's what I say. Not just African-American, but any dialects of the African diaspora, I am fascinated with. Anywhere on the planet where Black people were, I want to know how they sound. Right. And it's just in my DNA. I just gravitate toward it. And clearly I do everything. you know, because I know the International Phonetic Alphabet. I know there's a phonetic sound for every sound that we utter. There's a phonetic symbol. There's a musical notation for every sound that you sing. Every musical note has a notation. The same thing holds true for how we speak. And again, it's more than the sounds. It's the rhythm. It's the inflection. It's the difference. Like I often say, it's the difference between the way my people make collard greens and the way someone makes collard greens from Texas or New Orleans, because my people are from South Carolina. And I don't know if you've ever been to Sylvia's restaurant, but her name is Sylvia Woods, and I'm Denise Woods. And those are my people from Sylvia's restaurant. And so I'm proud to say. And so it's just fascinating to me. We are of Geechee Gullah roots. Mm-hmm. Yes, girl.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I'm fascinated with that region of America.
Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah, it's incredibly fascinating. I'd love to hear about how you get someone who has a totally different accent, totally different dialect, to where their character needs to be at.
We start with listening. It all starts with your ear.
Okay.
And I develop people's ears first. And some people's ears are more developed than others. My ear is developed because I was an opera singer. I sang with the New York City Opera when I was a child. Before I was an actress, I wanted to be an opera singer. And I studied opera. And what happened was I read my first Shakespeare play, understood it, got it, and went, oh my gosh, I have to do this. And so I went to the High School of Performing Arts, and then I went to Juilliard, but in the drama division, for acting, not for voice. I got into the High School of Music and Art for voice, and I chose performing arts for drama because I just felt a connection to words and language. And so I give you all of that background to say that I have developed my ear over the years. And really, the development of my ear started around my table on a Sunday after church. We would sit around, have dinner like we do 2 o'clock after church. You come home, you have that Sunday meal, everybody's around the table. And my mom is the perfect mimic. We got it from my mother. We would mimic everybody at church and we would devise routines. It was our wonderful way of entertainment, Sunday afternoon entertainment. We had everyone down. And it was my mother who initiated it. So it was really a family thing where we would just, I don't want to say mimic or imitate, because we didn't just have their voice, but we had their physicality. We would just go in and devise these people. And church was our playground because there were characters in the Baptist church. Oh, baby, it was so much fun. Little did I know that was the ground that foundation was being laid and the ear was being developed. And then I started studying music and then drama and language. And so all of that, it is the ear. Now, some people have a wonderful proclivity toward hearing what that sound is, and some people don't. And if you don't hear the sound, then I start rhythmically, because it's not just about the sound, but it's about the rhythm, it's about the inflection. So it would be essentially tantamount to, what do you put into a pot of gumbo? Yes, you've got the main, the stock, you've got the meat, but then you've got those spices that really make it a gumbo and not a soup. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if you've got the stock and you've got the chicken, that's a soup, but you put in those spices. And so we start with the spices sometimes, because sometimes people can't get the main stock of, or the main basis of the dialect. And you start with the visuals. You start with, sometimes, believe it or not, I start physiologically, and I did this with Mahershala Ali in Green Book, Dr. Donald Shirley, to find that erudite way in which he spoke and that rhythm of speech that was ostensibly African-American, mm-hmm. but one who was a prodigy, one who was world-traveled. And to get that, I just said to Mahershala, what I want you to do is I want you to lengthen your spine. I want you to think that you're a marionette and you've got a string coming from the top of your head. And I want you to feel as if you're being lifted and pulled up from the top of your head. And I want you to create that space in your spine and in your neck. And it just sort of lifted him off of his hips. It lengthened his spine. It extended his head up. And out of that came this kind of voice that when it happened, I started crying. He said, oh my God, Denise, oh my, he just created this space. This grand kind of voice came out of that cavernous space that he had just created physiologically. And like I said, I started crying because we knew that moment he had the character and he never looked back.
Wow. Yeah.
I know. It's amazing.
I'm assuming that this person would have to have some level of exposure or existing, you know, connection to the characters, which would make your process.
Well, the great thing about doing a biopic is you actually have footage, you know, a contemporary biopic.
Right.
And you actually have footage that you can listen to. And it's a blessing and a curse, because the blessing is you've got footage. The curse is you've got footage, meaning you've got to stick to what this is. You know, you've got to stay within the lines. Mm. You've got to color within the lines as much as you can. And so, yes, it helps when you come to the table with a sense of craft, but it's basically the same as teaching a musician to play and he can play by ear and he doesn't read music. And his performance is equally as beautiful as, and sometimes more beautiful than the musician who reads music. And so he comes in with little technical proficiency, but there's more that gut kind of raw energy that a person brings to the music. And the same holds true with this work. I mean, most of the actors that I work with now come to the work with a level of training, either in conservatory or in MFA program or acting school. In this day and age, very few people come to this game without having some chops and craft under their belts. And so any acting teacher worth their metal will say, you've got to have voice training as well. And so even if they don't go to conservatory, they study acting privately or in a group setting locally, a good acting teacher is going to say, develop your voice, develop your vocal chops, and they do. And so yes, to answer your question, most times people come to the table with some knowledge of this. But mm-hmm. again, if you have no knowledge of this, I taught kids, you know, how do you teach kids? Okay, no knowledge of this, no craft, because I tell parents, do not put your kid in an acting class. They have their entire career to train. Let their natural, raw talent come through. But then how do you work with a kid that has not trained? And what you do is you use your imagination. You know, it's imagination. I say really good actors are actors who have childlike imaginations, who really think outside the box and who color outside of the lines. And it's that kid that the teacher had to keep saying, will you sit down? Will you be quiet? It's that kid, you know, that makes the great artist, the one that's mm-hmm. pushing yep. the envelope, constantly asking questions, you know. So, and by the time they get to film, these kids really love pushing the envelope and love play, and that's all this is. It's just play. Just imagine, you know. So, yeah.
Got it. Got it. Awesome.
You've talked a lot about developing an ear. I'm wondering if there is a limit. Do some people have a limit to what they're capable of doing with their accents? For example, you know, I'm not a actor, a trained actor, anything like that, and I'm not that great at doing accents. But I have a friend, a colleague who's pretty good at doing accents. I mean, he's not a master, but he's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, like, are there limits? How much of this is based upon natural talent, just the talent to do an accent? And how much of it is just like, yeah, how much of it is natural when it comes to your voice? Like, do some people just have that voice? Like somebody like a Jay Farrow, is he just blessed with a great voice? I guess the question is, could I be Jay Farrow? Like if I really yes. tried my hardest.
Yes, you can. I say that because I wholeheartedly believe that you be the best you that you can be. So you don't have to go after someone else's greatness. Develop and go after your own. And so it really does not depend on raw talent, because I have seen actors who have, as we say, raw talent, and they still have that raw talent in their living rooms. And I have seen major stars who have wonderful careers develop that, let's say, modicum of talent. And just by doing it over and over, and the commitment to craft and study and putting in the time is, in my opinion, it outweighs raw talent. Now, if you get both of those elements, if you get raw talent and that undeniable work ethic, then you got a phenom, because it's the raw talent meets the impeccable work ethic. And then let's add a great humanitarian, someone with a great soul and heart. Those three, then you have genius. Then you know, that's, but those three components don't have to exist in an artist. I mean, I've worked with people who were narcissistic and could care less about the artist across from them if it didn't pertain to them. And they were brilliant because they work very, very hard. They work very hard. And so I really think it's a trifecta. And I don't necessarily think that one is more important than the other. The humanitarian in a person outweighs the raw talent, or the diligence to craft outweighs raw talent. You know, it really just depends on how much you want to give to this craft. Mm-hmm. How much you want to sacrifice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that sacrifice at the end of the day is you becoming the best version of you that you can be. And then, and when I say that hard, that work ethic is not just on craft, that work ethic is on business too. You know, yeah. How do you market yourself? How do you know what is your best? How do you know to say, I am really good at this. I'm okay at that, but I really want to get good at that. And then you go, I really want to get good at that, but this right here, right now, is going to be my bread and butter. And so while I do this, it's spinning plates. While I'm doing my bread and butter, I'm going to work on the thing that I've always wanted to do. And so these plates are spinning, and the people that can navigate that can really sort of work on the craft while they're working on the business of acting and sustaining themselves as professional actors and continuing to push the envelope to make them better actors, as opposed to staying in the safe zone, but pushing themselves to further that need to play in the sandbox they become really, really good actors. Really good actors. Mm-hmm. It's the being courageous as opposed to saying, well, I don't have a natural talent for it. But the one that says, yeah, I don't have a natural talent for it, but I'm going to try. And I'm going to get good.
That's Will Smith.
And I'm going to work.
That's
I'm
Will
gonna,
Smith.
See, and this is another thing. I'm going to work on this before the opportunity comes. Because a lot mm-hmm. of people wait for the opportunity yeah. to come and then they work. And that's no. You work now. You work now. And so if you say, and I have actors that do this. They say to me, Denise, these British actors are coming here doing American acting on dialects. I want to learn the British ones. Mm. And I'm like, I'm not mad at you, sis. Come on, let's do this, you know?
Wow, that's yes. awesome.
Yes, awesome. Yes. I have several American actors that say to me, Denise, I want Cockney, I want British, I want Caribbean. Hmm. Yeah, before they need it.
That's
and when amazing. I say Caribbean, you know, we can break that down to Trinidad and Jamaica because they're totally different, as you know. Because I totally go to Trini. You know, people say to me, no, that's not Jamaican, girl. That is Trini. You know, I go, because it's a little bit sing-songy, you know. So
it is. Yeah.
It's more sing-songy. And again, why? It's because of the Indian influence in
yeah.
Trinidad.
Yeah.
You know? I love yep. this stuff.
I love your energy. Reggie, go ahead. You had a question?
I'll ask it later because it might blow up the whole interview. So I'll ask it towards
okay,
the end.
Okay, all right.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
All
go
right.
Ahead,
well, ahead. I have a question, one quick question. On average, how many hours do you spend training someone, especially someone who's a novice, to do this?
You know? Okay, that's great. And the reason why I laugh is because I don't just do dialect training. I do voice work.
Okay.
And when I say voice work, sometimes people talk like this and not all of your characters speak like that. What I tell people is I give people choices, vocal choices, speech choices. So I never say something is good, this is good, this is bad. This is the way Americans speak. What do you mean this is the way American? Oh, this is standard American speech. By whose standards are we judging? Mm. You know, so I never come in to the table with good, this is good, you know, white people speak well, black people don't. Oh my gosh. Oh, how many times have I had to debunk that notion when African-American brother or sister comes in the office? I'm like, oh no, boo. Mm-mm. We are not going to even entertain that notion. Not here.
Right.
And this is to answer your question. What I do is, and it's the reason why I'm so blessed in my career, because I give away a lot of sessions to particularly actors of color, but not just actors of color, but any actor who cannot afford to study like this. I give it away. And I give it away because I say, sweetheart, you can't afford not to do this. They go, I had a sister that came in one time. She was rocking this $2,000 purse. I'll never forget. And she said, I can't afford this. And I wanted to say, sell that purse. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. I said, sweetheart, you can't afford not to do this.
Mm.
And I'm going to train you for free until I hear a significant difference. And she was blown away. She said, no one does that. I said, well, I believe what you put out, you get back. And true to form, true to my belief system, this girl worked her butt off. She was so grateful. She showed up early. I mean, we had such a beautiful, beautiful relationship and student-teacher camaraderie. So much so in 3 months, she really started sounding different, and she went back to the agent who told her, you need speech work. And I won't say where she's from because I really want to be very private with who she is. And when I say where she's from, you'll know. But it was a Northeastern urban environment, and we have a tendency to sound a particular way. And the thing about that is, it's not that no one's trying to take that away. What I try to do is add other colors to that. What I say is, wouldn't you prefer to have a crayon box with 64 colors as opposed to a crayon box of crayon with just 8, like the primary colors and a couple of secondary colors? Wouldn't you rather have 5 shades of green and 4 shades of brown? And, you know, and so we can do that with the boys, because once you do that, you can play a myriad of different characters from all over the globe. And she bought in. And in 3 months' time, this sister was, and still is, because I just spoke to her, amazing. And so this is what she did. She went back to that agent who told her, nope, sorry, nope, I can't work with you. I just can't. She goes back to him, and 3 months later, and he goes, oh my God, what did you do? And she said, Denise Woods. He said, who? She said, you don't know Denise Woods? He said, no. And she puts down my card on his desk, and she says, this is the woman. She trained me. He said, you sound amazing. He called me up immediately and said, Denise, he's an Italian guy from Brooklyn. And he calls me up. He says, Denise, Taraji's getting ready to play this scientist that, you know, she doesn't want to sound like Cookie. You think you could train her? I'm serious. So he's Taraji P. Henson's manager. He's Halle Berry's manager. He hooked me up, just that, putting that into the universe, giving that woman these lessons. She went to this agent. They happened to represent Taraji. I then do, okay, look at this. I then did Hidden Figures and talked to, so he tells me, he says, okay, talk to Taraji. She's on vacation. She has 1 week to prep for this. I'm gonna give you the director's phone number. And he does. I speak to the director. The director says, this sounds wonderful. What can I do to convince you to come down to Atlanta and work with all the girls? I said, I would love to. So I get down, I'm working with all the ladies, and Miss Octavia Spencer, I love her. She said, baby, I'm from the South. I don't need a dialect coach. I said, I love you, okay? That's good. That's great. She was so sweet. They all were. But then I'm on set, and who plays Taraji's husband, Katherine Johnson's husband, but Mahershala Ali. And he comes over to me because I taught at Juilliard and he went to NYU, and he comes over to me. He said, Denise Woods, I heard you were on this movie. You're legendary. And I'm just dying to work with you, but I can't afford you yet. I said, okay. He said, but the moment I can, I will work with you. 2 years later, here comes Green Book. Now, trace this all the way back. Green Book, Mahershala, Hidden Figures, to this girl who comes into my office and says, I can't afford you. And I said, you can't afford not to, babe. I got you. I got this. And I mean, that story. And then I got Halle Berry. And one tells another and tells another and tells, you got to go to Denise Woods. You got to go to Denise. I've just had a blessed career. I'm sorry. Thank God we're not filming, because I'm tearing up.
No, it's okay.
I've had a blessed career because I've put out and I've been so gracious. And I've been gracious because not everybody comes to this work with the same knowledge of what this work is. And sometimes to get that knowledge of what this work is going to cost them a fortune, which they don't have. And by the time they understand it, like you said, how long does it take? It varies from individual to individual. And if you don't stay with it, you know, it's like a diet. It's like a lifestyle. Like, I just went plant-based, y'all. I just went plant-based.
Congratulations. I'm trying.
I am loving this. I feel like, I'm not going to even tell you how many days in. I'm not that far in. But I use that as an example of my life has changed. And I know, and that's why you are the only thing on my calendar this week, because I am devoting this entire week to this lifestyle change, to doing what I have to do It's not cheap. It's expensive. It's this, it's that. And that's this, I'm likening it to what training your voice is like. It's a lifetime commitment to your instrument, to your craft. Mine is a lifetime instrument to my health. It wasn't vanity. I was like, girl, I need to lose 30 pounds. It wasn't that. It was like, girl, I don't want diabetes. Mm-hmm. I don't want hypertension.
Yeah.
So it's that lifelong commitment that I've made that actors make to their craft. And it really pays off. It really, really does, because you're so much more facile. You have the facility to do so much more. You can find an agent when an agent can cast you as, you know, Latina from the Lower East Side. Because that's where I grew up, baby. I grew up in the projects on the Lower East Side. And they used to say to me, because I have light eyes, you know. And they used to say, Dominicana? I go, no, negra. You know, Dominicana? No, negra. You know, just the ability to play and to go there and to do all of these different things. So I haven't even gotten my British, you know, I kind of, you know, I've done Jamaican, I've done Caribbean, you know, I've got Cockney going on here. You know, it's the ability to do all of those things with relative ease that you want to give an actor these tools to be able to do that. That's the bottom line. The ability to transform. And that comes with imagination and then craft and then determination to just stick with it. Like, I'm sticking with this. Y'all check back in a month and say, Denise, are you still playing bass? I'm going to say, yeah, girl, because I don't want my blood pressure going up.
You can do it. You can do it. I'm right with you. Yeah, no, I'm trying to be vegetarian for now.
Got you.
Because I was pescatarian. I've been pescatarian for about a year. So,
yes.
So now we're you know, I'm going into being a vegetarian, and then slowly, hopefully, I can become vegan by 2020.
Yes.
Yeah.
See, I was trying to do it that kind of gradual way. Mm-hmm. Me, mm-hmm. I am cold turkey. You got, and see, the gradual for me is cheating. Cold turkey.
I got you. I got you.
I can't. Anyway, so but I digress. But I was using that as an example of what you put in, you get out in the universe. Mm-hmm. In the universe, not just in my body, in my mouth, for my health, but in the universe. You know, people will come to my studio, they'll buy a package of four. They're working so hard. I go, this one's on me. They go, what? I go, this one's on me. They go, no. I go, yep, it's on me. So you got one more. You know, and it just comes back. It really, really does, because it really, and that's why I throw them in, because it, especially when I see a person is working and I know their money is tight, you know, I cut them a break, because it's a real commitment to this work. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So when you are working with actors, or whether it's a public speaker, whoever you're working with, what is your style in regards to directing them? Are you offering suggestions? Are you kind of making it feel as if they're coming up with the idea? Or are you just saying, this is what you need to do? Or is there something else I'm missing? Like, what is your style?
Darling, 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 these are excellent questions. These are great, great questions. Without giving away too much, because I've just written a book, shameless plug here. Thank you. It's called The Power of Voice. Mm. And Mahershala Ali wrote the foreword. Awesome. And Halle Berry contributed to the book. Soledad O'Brien contributed to the book. So I've worked with broadcast journalists, a brother who's a CEO of a company who was on the board, he was the CFO, he was the chief financial officer. And the board members told him that he wasn't articulate enough. Heard that before, y'all? Mm. Heard that? Mm-hmm. Have you heard that before? He wasn't articulate enough. Mm-hmm. And this brother has degrees up the wazoo and is extraordinarily articulate. And he's just a math and science guy. He's a numbers guy. So he doesn't speak like me. I'm an artist. You can tell the way I use my voice. My niece, who's now 39, when she was four, she asked me at 4, why do you talk with so much emotion at 4? And I said, because I'm an actress, darling. I'm an actress. But not everyone is. And so just because you don't speak like this doesn't mean you're inarticulate. And so what does that mean? And so he's in the book, and he did make CEO of the company, of this Fortune 500 company. And we really worked on just different presentational skills that unfortunately in the workplace, an African-American needs to always prove themselves. Because I said to him, I said, you know, if you were white, this conversation would not be had. We would not be having this conversation. He goes, oh, of course, of course. I said, oh, okay, we got that clear. You know, the double standard, you know, that you don't take for granted that the reason why the man is a quiet man, he's a thinker, he thinks, he's more pensive. According to them, he was inarticulate. So he contributed to the book as well. And the reason why I bring all of this in, it's again, it's called The Power of Voice. I have a transgender woman that contributed. I've got the spectrum. I contribute my story. And that's how, to answer your question, that's how I start, because I start from me. I gain people's trust by telling and showing, illustrating my experience, my journey through this speech maze that has a tendency to be quite Eurocentric and racist, you know? Mm-hmm. And the paradigms are these ivory tower standardized paradigms that are now breaking down, because the one other thing on my week schedule, in addition to doing my vegan stuff, plant-based stuff, is I'm doing a town hall meeting at Juilliard tomorrow, not just for the African-American students, but for the entire community, to talk about the approach that Juilliard has had to speech for decades, and how they are going to change the conversation around speech, the terminology, the curriculum, what they're bringing to the table in terms of the reading lists. The whole curriculum is changing, and I'm going to be a part of that conversation, and I'm grateful for
that's
that.
Dope.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really, really is. I mean, the students at Juilliard, I haven't taught at Juilliard. I left Juilliard in 2000. I started teaching at Juilliard in 92. Viola Davis was on her way out when I was coming in, so I didn't teach her, but I taught Anthony Mackie and a host of wonderful African-American actors, and Jessica Chastain and Sara Ramirez were my students. And it was tough. It was a really, really tough environment, in this ivory tower approach to Eurocentric approach to what good speech is. And that was part of the reason I left, because it was really trying to convince teachers that I had in the 70s when I went to Juilliard, trying to convince them in the 90s that needed to be changed. And now we're in 2020 and they're just having the conversation post Breonna Taylor and, you know, our Floyd brother, you know, and now we're having the serious conversation about the approach to speech. I mean, and we've been clamoring, we've been pushing the envelope, pushing the door, pushing it, and talking, saying we've got to stop discussing speech this way. We have to be more inclusive in our approach to speech. It can't be a standard way of speaking, because by whose standard are you judging? Mm-hmm. And so I say that my approach to working with artists is usually garnering their trust and letting their guard down, because a lot of times actors come to this work with a lot of trepidation. They feel that you're going to in some way infringe on their ideas for the character. And I am just there to support, to give you the support that you need to fulfill the vocal idea for the character. And so how I do that a lot of times is winning their trust by talking a lot about my journey. A lot of times in my first, which is the reason why I give away a lot because my first session, we don't do any work. We just talk. We basically level the playing field, and so that we can play. And we can play from a place of trust and honesty. And that's my initial approach is to use myself as a subject and then get their trust. And then I start saying, okay, then I line out what the curriculum is going to be, what the approach is going to be. And that varies from person to person. As I've alluded to before, you know, depending on how much training they've had or how little training they've had, sometimes I'll start and I'll get to know that person in that first session and really start, you know, with, sometimes I start with Shakespeare. You know, I just jump right in if we're training and not, you know, for a specific role, you know, because then we get right to the role. Because if we only have 4 days, then I got to jump right into the deep end of the pool. Mm-hmm. But if we're training over a long period of time and we've got a little comfort and I get to know the person, I throw them into the deep end of the pool and say, I'm going to give you Lady Macbeth. And they go, what? No, I've never done Shakespeare. I go, no, I know. But you can, and that's why we're going to do this. And so basically, like the analogy that you said, you're going pescatarian, and then you're going to go vegetarian, and then you're going to go vegan. And I said, nope, I got to go all out. I got to be thrown into the deep end of the pool, and that's how I learned how to swim. I can't go start in the shallow part and go across and get to the deep part. I have to go into the deep part. That's what I know about myself. And that's what I get to know in a first meeting. And I have a wonderful spirit of discernment. I can discern in the first meeting, just listening to a person's voice, where they are in their family. Usually 9 times out of 10, I'm correct. I go, are you the baby? And she'll say, yeah, how'd you know? Just, you know, or do you have siblings? And they go, yes. Because for an only child, I can't hear it. And my son's an only child, so they're different. But where they come in the hierarchy, I can hear it in the voice. And then, or I'll say, you're a daddy's girl, aren't you? Go, yeah, how'd you know? It's sort of becoming a speech detective. Then you know how to approach things. Then you know the approach to take once you, again, and it's tuning your ear, you know, getting a vibe from somebody, feeling their vibe and knowing how to approach. There is no one way to do this. I don't have a stock, you know, one fits all approach to this work, one way fits all approach at all, because you're screwed if you do. Everybody's an individual. And because I've been at this a long time, I don't have a fear of telling people that I don't know something. That's liberating. When I can unequivocally say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's so liberating. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
It did. Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I wanted to know, do you at any point interact with the director throughout this process? And if so, how does that usually go?
I'm very hands-on with the director. It usually goes, I speak with them before we get on set, and then I stay out of their way on set. Okay. And it's so interesting. I had a director come to me, and she said, and this was Casey Lemons from, she directed Harriet.
Yeah,
Casey's my girl. Casey said, lives in Harlem. And Casey said, Denise, girl, it was so good to have you on that set. She said, when those actors show up, I knew that you had worked with them and I could do my job. Hmm. I was just blown away. And she said this to me at the wrap party. And we never discussed anything. We talked at the beginning, what she was looking for. I said, okay, I got it, no problem. And then I stay out of the way. I really, really stay out of the way. I come in, the bulk of my work is done when the actor is in hair and makeup in the mornings. You know, before they go on, we prep. I try not to go in at lunch because they need that time to just that is their time to just rest. But in the morning, I prep the actor, and we're off and running. And this is a more crucial point to your point. A lot of times, it all depends on what the director's doing. And so if the director shoots on the star first, then we gotta be on our game. If he's not, and it varies depending on what the director's looking for, you know, they'll take a wide shot first, and it gives the actors a chance to, and you guys are filmmakers, so you know, you know better than I, you know, that gives a chance, you know, for the actors to warm up. And so when the camera's on the actor is when I'm doing my real, real job, real stuff, because it's the nuances, you know, the vocal nuances that translate into the eyes. And so when the camera is not on the actor, a lot of times I don't go in, I just let the actor find it, you know, rather than being in their ear to then have them get into their heads about their performance. I let them find it. And then by the time it turns around on them, if they haven't found it, I then go in and I have, it's the reason why directors like to work with the same DP, why mm-hmm. artists like, musicians like to work with the same producers. It's the reason why actors like to work with the same coaches, because we then develop a language, you know, and I understand, you know, that I just give you two words and those two words, you know, because you don't need a whole cacophony of notes because you're in character. You just need two words that are going to just turn that, you know, sink in. It might be an image. It might be, you know, something that we had worked on, a gentle reminder of something. And so you go in with that because less is more. And then there are actors that want you to tell them straight out, just tell me. You know, I had an actor like scream at me on set one time because I just gave him a couple words and was out, because that's how I'm used to working. He's like, what are you saying? Okay. And so you got to have a little bit of tough skin, because you know that it's a very pressure-filled situation and you can't take things personally. Usually people don't go off on me, but when they do, admittedly, I just go, Denise, it's not you, it's the situation. And then one time it was me. One time I showed up to set and I was coaching a white actress and I was the only person of color. Maybe they had one person, one grip, maybe one black grip, that's it, and me. And so I show up to set and this white guy looks at me, because she showed up with her dialect coach and her acting coach, and I was the only black woman and only second black person. And he looks at me and I said, this is gonna be trouble. The way he looked at me, they did the first shot, he said cut, and he looks at me and he said, does that sound like a fucking New York accent to you?
What?
I said, it fucking does, because I'm from New York, motherfucker. Everybody wow. went, well, needless to say, I was fired. And I don't care. Because I said to my agent, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not having it. I'm not having it. You know, I said, it does, motherfucker. I'm old enough to be your mother. That's what I told him. I'm old enough. This was 20 years ago. So I was in my 40s. I'm old enough to be your mother. Don't you ever. I said, nobody talks to me like that. This is a New York accent. I'm from New York, motherfucker.
Brilliant.
And I went there. Anyway, I was fired.
Man, no, that's like incredibly rude. And
oh, my
obnoxious.
Gosh. Oh my gosh. I'm sorry, am I cursing? Is it
No,
that's cool.
It's fine.
But I'm cursing in the context of what of the story.
Yeah.
No, it's totally
Yeah. So to your point, it all depends. You know, you kind of go in and you feel the situation out. You know that I am here to help everybody. I am not here to star. This is not my show. I'm here to help the director. So how much help or how little help, you know, the director will let me know, you know. Or one time a director let the first AD, he comes to me, he said, you know, the director said that don't be so finicky with the dialect because we can get it in post. In other words, he wants me to stay out. He goes, yeah, please. I said, okay, no problem. But you know, again, it all depends on what they're looking for. So, and on set, I typically hang out with the sound guy. I'm sitting there with the sound person, sound woman, because I've worked with some fierce sisters and in sound. And if I'm not with sound, I'm with hair and makeup. So that's where I hang out on set with my hair and makeup crew, because it's so interesting because we develop relationships and this wonderful jockeying, because while they're doing hair and makeup in the hair and makeup room, I'm there, you know, going all through lines and going through dialect in the morning in the hair and makeup trailer. So we're there getting around. And then when we're on set and they're getting touched up, I'm there with him going in, or her going in, you know, giving notes. It's like this team of hair, makeup, dialect. And my hair and makeup crew on several movies are my ride or die. They've become my best friends. We have nothing to do, our crafts have nothing to do with each other, but we work as a team because they're doing the look and I'm doing the voice, you know? And it's great. Yeah.
Nice. It's awesome. It sounds like you've had an amazing career and you've accomplished a lot of awesome things. So
thank you, sweetheart. I'm blessed.
Of course. Yeah.
I'm really blessed. I'm fortunate and I'm blessed. And I'm blessed to be in a position to give a little bit back. You know, why else? Why are we here? Why else are we put on this earth? Yeah. You know, to give back something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Well, Denise. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for finding me. I think Gabby found me.
Yes, yeah, she did.
Gabby. Shout out to Gabby, our producer.
Big shout out. I love her.
Before we let you go, we'd love to hear how folks can stay in touch with you.
Speak It Clearly. SpeakItClearly.com. is my website. Speak It Clearly. Speak It Clearly Facebook, Speak It Clearly Twitter, Speak It Clearly IG.
Got it.
And then I have a Speak It Clearly page on Facebook, but then you can find me, Denise Woods, on Facebook.
Okay, awesome, perfect. Reggie, were you gonna say something?
I was just gonna ask, do you know when your book is coming out?
Yes, thank you for asking. The Power of Voice is on Amazon right now for pre-order, ready for pre-order. It comes out the end of January. And I wrote it 3 years ago. I started the journey in 2017. And it's been wonderful. I got a great publishing deal with HarperCollins. And it comes out January 26th. And from the onset, they said, we never launch a book during an election year. Little did they know, thank God, what that 2020 was gonna be what it is. You know, how can a book compete with this? Who's gonna launch a book in this? Unless you're Trump's niece or one of Trump's cronies.
Yeah, yeah.
How can I compete with those books?
Yeah, totally.
So, well, yes.
Thank you again. We will definitely be in touch.
Please, this was so much fun. Thank you for the wonderful, astute, really astute questions that I'm sure a lot of people had the same question. You asked it, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Denise.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful week.
Thank you. Wish me luck.
Yes, I was going to say good luck with your night.
You can do it. You can do it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Black Film Space podcast. This episode was co-executive produced by Gabrielle Charles and Sino Gibson and was edited by Elon Pitoff. If you're interested in being part of our community and attending events, please visit us at blackfilmspace.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Black Film Space. Subscribe to our email list and podcast. All right, see you soon.